It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Convergence. This is the Speaking Candy Show live. Convergence 2014. Woo! Thank you so much for indulging me on that. That would have been very sad. I'm the moderator, Michael Lauerwitz. Since this is recording, we're going to identify ourselves a little bit so that listeners in future years, for millennia to come, will not go, who's that guy? So we're joined by two marvelous authors and three of my wonderful co-hosts from the Speaking and Candy Show. So we're going to move down the line, and I'm going to ask each person to identify themselves and give a short intro, and this will especially help our future listeners know who we all are. And for anyone who wants to know more about our panelists, so starting with Martha.
I'm Martha Wells, a fantasy writer. I've been writing for about 21 years now. My most recent books are the Books of the Raxora series, also a couple of YA fantasies from Strange Chemistry, Emily in the Sky World, and Emily in the Hollow World, and also have some media tie-in, a Star Wars novel, and a couple of Stargate Atlantis novels.
Hi, my name is Carrie Patel, and I'm also an author. My first novel, The Buried Life, comes out on July 29th, and I'm delighted to be here with y'all.
David Annandale, write horror and thrillers and Warhammer 40,000 fiction, and co-host Dragooned Into This with Sean Duke and Paul.
I'm Sean Duke. I like run this thing, I guess. So, yeah, I'm one of the original host people of the Skipping Fanny Show, so that's about it. That's about it.
Yeah. I'm Paul Weimer. I'm one of the co-hosts of the Skipping Fanny Show. I do blogging, podcasting, and all sorts of geekery reviewing stuff.
Alright, so this is our first ever live panel episode at conventions. We recorded at conventions before, but this is a brand new format, so we'll see what kind of things explode and erupt in joyful awesomeness. The topic I pitched for this panel is influences on science fiction and fantasy literature from gaming, comics, and other media. And we have among our guests folks who work in other media and have other kind of geek activities professionally and on their own. And then each of our co-panelists has their own levels of expertise in terms of the interaction between SF media, other cultural properties, and SF and lit. So I'd love to start with the question for Carrie, which would be, how has gaming, video gaming, and otherwise influenced science fiction and fantasy literature in your writing and more broadly? How do you see kind of the influence of gaming, video gaming, role-playing gaming on literature now in SF?
Well, I think that one thing that you get in a lot of games that are being made nowadays and that, you know, you've had for over a decade really is a lot of world building. I think out of all of the aspects of science fiction and fantasy that we love, really clear, gorgeous, and really evocative world building is one thing that definitely comes through in games because, you know, even if you're telling a nonlinear story or even if you're telling less of a story and just giving the player a really visceral experience, you can get the world in the sights and the sounds and in, you know, the way the NPCs talk to you. So I think that's one thing that's also come back to literature in a lot of ways. And I think that that's one thing that we'll continue to see, you know, more and more of in both games and literature.
Does anyone else have thoughts on influences you see in SFNF from gaming, video gaming, or role-playing gaming?
Sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Influences on SFNF literature from video gaming and role-playing gaming.
I think I would second what Carrie said, the world. Bill, what gaming gives us, whether it's in video games or in tabletop or games with popular wargaming or role-playing gaming is a gigantic sandbox in which to play. And so all the toys are there to create the narratives. And rather than, for instance, restrictions in some ways, I think they're like the tools that suggest all sorts of ways in which we can go with the stories.
I think in gaming, it always feels like the world is infinitely expandable, that you're not just trapped in that one little part of it. There's no boundary. There's all these places, spaces left to be explored. And I really like that in more modern fantasy, the feeling that I'm not just bound by this little tiny, I'm not just in this little tiny valley or these little tiny mountains or even a big map. It's like there's edges and places to go that the world will just keep expanding.
So I'm going to go directly to the kind of obvious question. What does SNF literature look like without Dungeons and Dragons? And what effect does it have on the genre?
That's a Paul question.
That's a Paul question. Without Dungeons and Dragons came out of a number of different sources in the Coco appendix, and a lot of it coming out of the pulp magazines and pulp stories like Fritz Leiber, Jack Vance, and so forth. If you don't have Dungeons and Dragons, I think you get a very different sort of feel for fantasy. I think you get a lot more stuff like Gormenghast and a lot more fantasy of affected hearts, stuff that we're seeing today, certainly, and it's always been there, but I think without Dungeons and Dragons, you don't get the 80s David Eddings sort of fantasy, and which has continued through to this day and still sits through. I mean, you just look at Brandon Sanderson's Way of Kings, it very much feels like he's taken his role-playing experience with Dungeons and Dragons and taken elements of that and put into his magic and his worlds building and his magic systems. And without Dungeons and Dragons, you get smaller fantasy. I don't think you'd have any real epic fantasy at all. You still have Tolkien, but without Dungeons and Dragons to pull that cart forward, I think fantasy looks very, very, very different. It's something to think about. Thoughts, Ron?
I wonder too that it was a question that I raised in an episode a long, long time ago, and I just didn't know the answer to this. The fact that so many fantasy writers actually played Dungeons and Dragons at some point before they became writers, and I don't know how many people on the panel have actually played Dungeons and Dragons.
Just about all of us.
Oh, very much. What about in the audience?
I actually did Call of Cthulhu. I'm going to get Dungeons and Dragons once or twice. But
okay.
Call of Cthulhu and my ass life was the big ones we did in college.
Okay. Yeah, and even with something like Call of Cthulhu, I mean, that can serve as a gateway. I feel like Dungeons and Dragons very much serves as a gateway for a lot of authors. It's this little world we can play in, and then you realize, like, if you ever run your own game, you're, like, writing a thing. It's not quite a novel, it's some sort of other monstrosity, but it is a writing experience, and even as a player, you are contributing to the creation of that thing, and so I think it feeds that in some ways. Now, whether or not something else would have come in the wake of, like, if Dungeons & Dragons hadn't come up and they just come up with something else, I don't know. But it's obviously had a profound influence on people who are themselves writers. One of the cons, didn't Mike Cole do a whole, like, Dungeons & Dragons recording ninja session? I can't remember. But
Confusion has had all their D&D now for 3 years running, and they've gotten to recording it. So
okay.
It's a very clear and present announced influence.
Right.
So, Carrie, you work in game design as a narrative designer. How does kind of switching back and forth between those two modes, like how does that affect your writing, and what do you need to do differently for each media?
I think one thing I've really come to appreciate about writing for games is the dialogue editor. It's a fantastic way to map out exactly where you're going in a conversation and to make sure you're hitting all the right points. And it's organization that's built right into the medium. For those who aren't familiar with it, the way the one that I work with works is, you have these different text boxes and you can connect them either through player chosen responses or through different conditionals that may change based on something that has or hasn't happened in the world or a certain trait the player may or may not have. And I think that sense of organization, being able to keep track of that mentally, is really important for any kind of writing, because you always need to know where your characters are going, where your story's going, and what the pacing of an experience is. And when you're looking at paragraphs, that's in there. But when you've got all these boxes laid out, you can see clearly, okay, this is where we start, this is where we end, and here are all the things we hit in between. And so I think trying to build that into my writing process for my my fiction, such as The Fairy Life, is something that's definitely been useful to me.
I'm going to jump on to a slightly related question, and partially just a chance for me to ask about Star Wars. Martha has worked in the Star Wars universe. What was your experience with Star Wars before coming to this, and like, how has that writing and storytelling experience been different than your established career working on creating your own IP?
Well, I was a big Star Wars fan from the time I was 13. I saw it, the first one when it first came out. And I wrote Star Wars fanfic. That was my first experience in fandom. Back when it was in fanzines and you kind of had to be in the know to be able to find them. And it was just, it wasn't online because there was no online at that point. So I've written characters before, but when you do, I've done two Stargate Atlantis novels long before I did a Star Wars book. So you really have to, stay within the universe, you have to stay within the canon, and you have to remember that the people you're writing for are not, the fanfic audience is a lot more freeform. Well, if you want to put dinosaurs in, you can just do that. And it's all for fun. And with the audience that for the media tie-ins, they're really looking to have the same experience that they get from the movie to the TV show. So you have to really keep that in mind. And also, Star Wars is a lot more strict than Stargate Atlantis was about what you do. They have to prove your outline and prove every part of it. And they really want to know what you can do in advance. There's not as much spontaneity. It's like everything's taken the outline. I actually like writing for Stargate Atlantis more because they didn't have that sort of control. It was just like, don't show anybody who's in the show. Unless they're already dead, then
Do you write by outline normally, or is that a different process for you?
No, I don't like the outline. I'm a seasoned pants writer, which means basically you kind of know where you're going to start, you kind of know where you're going, and you kind of know who the people are going to be, and then you just go. And sometimes that works out really well for you, and sometimes you do a lot of rewriting. But with with Star Wars, I really had to, the outline had to look the actor. I've outlined fantasy novels before, but the publisher, usually when they buy a book from like the first 50 pages of an outline, when you're an established author, they're not really expecting you to completely follow the outline. They're expecting, usually by the time you turn the book in, the editor doesn't remember what was in the outline, and she's not going to go look it up to see if you were accurate. They just kind of want to know that you have a plan for the book. And if the plan changes along the way, and it's okay, it's still a good book. But with, again, Star Wars, you have to really stick with what you said you were going to do.
So to go a bit more broadly, what do you do in literature, what do you see in literature that is really different from the way storytelling is done in other media, especially given how much of an economic and cultural shadow media SF has with movies and comics and video games? What do you see in SF lit, or what do you do in lit that you think can stand out and draw attention to itself or go further than, or really be distinct in a cool way from the bigger media properties or those media?
Okay. Yeah, we'll go. This is something actually I was discussing online with Damon G. Walter this morning about the idea of visual storytelling versus character storytelling. Science fiction movies, science fiction comics rely on the tropes and methodology of visual storytelling, and you can't always convert that into literature. Literature works while you can have action scenes and story beats that mimic some of that visual storytelling. In the end, what literature can do that comics to a lesser extent can't, and movies certainly can't, is build on character. You can delve into character relationships, character motivations, character arcs in a way in literature, in science fiction literature, in the best of science fiction literature, that a movie can't hope to. You couldn't spend 2 hours in a science fiction movie developing a character to the extent to the exclusion of the giant hiring robots. No one would go see it.
Yeah, I would add to that it's perhaps maybe more a matter of depth. That that a movie can certainly give us some really complex characters, but it is limited in how much depth it can show, because of course none of you are going to watch like a 9-hour movie in which we go through a character's entire like life and history, because that, well, maybe someone might, I don't know. But the idea that we're limited in the space, because a movie has a certain degree of time that is limited to it, whereas with a novel, you can have a 500-page novel in which you're delving into this character's deep psychology, right? And we're getting all of his motivations. We understand how he feels in every moment. Whereas, you know, Bruce Willis in Die Hard, we're limited. We don't really know everything that's going on in his head as he's, like, crawling around in an air duct, right? We know what he tells us. We know what we can see on his face. But inside his head, we don't have that, whereas a book can give us that. And to some extent, comics can give us that, too, but I think comics are a really good medium that they sort of intermix the two and just do very different things. That's not to suggest that a movie is, of course, inferior. It's just...
Or shallow, yeah.
I just think you have to recognize that the form has a limit, and you need to figure out how to play within that limit in a different way than something like a novel. That's not to say you should write, like, 500-page novels that are just about everything a character thinks. Although maybe, who knows, that might work.
Now, to pick up on that, the long-form storytelling that we see in television these days as opposed to the episodic, it does seem to sort of try to bridge that gap. To give a non-genre example, Breaking Bad, we get so much about Walter White and his world and the characters in there over that length of that entire season of the seasons of the show,
yeah,
that it does try to bridge that. But again, it only gives us in drips and drabs, and then it has to serve the restrictions of the form.
Yeah, I think that's true too. And I think it's something that until fairly recently, TV wasn't taking advantage of.
Right.
Because TV, really, compared to a movie, TV can do so much more than a movie can in terms of depth of character. But for some reason, that hadn't been the dominant mode, and now we're getting more and more of this, where you get these just really in-depth character studies in our sci-fi and fantasy. I mean, even Game of Thrones, to some extent, although it has so many different characters at the same time. So, yeah, but that would be my...
Well, I think that, yes, the inner life of the character that you have access to in the book, and also think that if you're with a very close POV, you're actually thinking that person's thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And you're actually being, you're running their software on your hardware while you're reading the book. So, and that's not an experience. We can get... sort of that experience from movies and TV, but not quite that intimate. And I think that's the fun of the book.
Yeah.
At the other end of the scale, you have an infinite budget with the book.
Yes.
And
no special effects restrictions.
Yeah. And I think in all of these cases too, it's that each medium has its own, not just limitations, but particular strengths. So things that movies can do that books can't do very well, that books can do that movies can't, that video games can do that no other medium can. And it's a question of knowing what the particular joys and strengths of the field you're working in has.
I was just going to add, I think that one thing that books can do that video games generally can't is tell ensemble stories. In most games, you have to center the story around a particular player character, and there are a few exceptions, such as the game adaptation of I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, but for the most part, you generally need to center the experience around one character that the player follows from start to finish, which is obviously something that you don't have to do in a book.
So, to continue this on the video games, I wanted to refer you carried into the group in total. What I've seen in terms of the key character storytelling of video games is I see some games that are where player choice is very limited, where it's basically one story is unfolding and you discover this character. And you have other games where it's much more self-directed, and you create the character's legend. How do you react to that difference in storytelling style? Where do you think it kind of benefits from or creates a limitation in terms of that particularity to video gaming?
I think they can both be a lot of fun. I think it's just good to know what you're going into when you start the game. With something like Morrowind or any of the other Elder Scrolls games, I always feel like I'm not really playing a story. I'm more just playing around in a world, and every once in a while I'll go back to this story when I've, you know, finished building my stronghold or whatever. And I think with more linear games where you have choice, the difficult thing is always making it meaningful choice. I think that's one complaint that you hear a lot of times, and reasonably so, which is, well, I got to make this choice, but it didn't really seem to affect anything. Maybe because it came at the very end, or maybe because even when you made the choice, it didn't really change anything about your experience going through the game. So I think it's it can be rewarding if you've got just a really big sandbox world, as you do in the Elder Scrolls, to just run around and play, and that can keep you entertained. But I think when you've got a more linear game where your choices are more limited, you have to make sure that all those choices that you have meaning and have an impact on what you do later.
For other folks, how does that aesthetic experience differ for you in those different types of games? What do you get out of the different games, and how are they distinct from one another?
Of course, again. I'm going to jump from Obsidian Entertainment to a different company and talk about the two Dragon Age games. And they're very different experiences. Dragon Age 1 is very much an epic fantasy. You build your build up your force, you gather your forces, and you go destroy the Archdemon. It's very typical in that way. I mean, there are some story choices that kind of change things, especially on who you pick and why you pick it. But it's relatively standard. Dragon Age 2 didn't do as well in the market, and it's because they're very different. It almost tries to beat a book in some way. It goes very episodic. We see scenes and parts of Hawk's life. We do have time jumps. Things happen that we only hear about in retrospect. It's a lot more ambitious, and in some ways I think it failed because players were looking for something more, looking for Dragon Age 1A rather than something different. And so I think just like any other form, video games can sometimes make experiments that don't always succeed.
Well, I guess the game that I would actually mention would be Knights of the Old Republic, which is actually a game which gives a great deal of choice. For me, that was a really great experience because I'd always wanted a game that I could play and I could be the bad guy, or I could be the good guy but have Force Lightning, which is also just as fun. It obviously has a certain limitations. Like, you're still following this main narrative, but the choices you make affect the kind of character that you become throughout the game. And I find that was, for me, a lot more very exciting, and more so than another type of game that is very limited, that has, like, you just have to follow the paths and figure out the puzzle and you're done, and there's no development of the character as you go along. But that's sort of my experience with something like that. But,
well, I think it depends, too, on what you're looking for as a gamer, whether it's the creation of a character, who you want to be, so like the example you just gave, or experiencing the revelation of a character. So the joys of Knights of the Old Republic are going to be very, very different from the joys of the most recent Tomb Raider. But and one might be also experiencing more of a world versus discovering who a character is, and so that's going to be two very different narrative jobs, as well as being very different narrative experiences for the player.
Yeah. I'll just add something really quick too. Just another different type of game is actually, does everyone play the original Half-Life?
Yeah.
And you have this main character, but he's never really a character in the game the entire time. It's actually his sort of unraveling of this mystery of this world as he goes along. We just sort of like learn that he has a name, and eventually we see his face. I think that's a kind of very different experience where the object is sort of unveiling what this world actually is about and what's going on, because you don't know at the beginning. You just know things have gone bad and craziness is happening. And that's part of, I think, the draw for me. It also terrified the heck out of me when I first played it. So just head crabs jumping out of vents was horrifying. So
yeah, I think that speaks to the different storytelling styles, which I can see some in literature. I think a deep character study is perhaps more in vogue within some chunks of SFNF right now, versus maybe the Half-Life model, where the character is static and the world is interesting, and basically there's different ways to foreground it, and again, you just need to signal what kind of story you're looking for. So to jump over from games to kind of film, if I may, I wanted to kind of throw the Kaiju Rising question at David, because David is well established in Stephen Kenny's show as our kaiju, resident kaiju expert. And there's an anthology that was produced and kickstarted that brought kaiju and giant monster storytelling to prose, which I hadn't seen as often. And I wanted to see if you could maybe talk a little bit about what that process is and what you think, like, how does that genre change from film, where it's very well established, into the literature, and what do you and what do you see your colleagues in an anthology do to make that transition?
I know when I was writing the story for that anthology, the big challenge was the description. I mean, the biggest joy for me as a viewer of kaiju films is watching the buildings fall down, and go boom, right? seeing the devastation, but just writing scene after scene after scene of okay, and then this block fell down, and then that block fell down, and then this building, and no, right? That would be, I guess, one of the examples where something that film can do that that literature can't as well. So it became, at least the approach that I took was more the meaning of the monster. What does this thing represent? And I think throughout the anthology, there is a whole sense of what is the symbol of the monsters? What do they? Where do they come from? Why are they there? Whether the reader's sympathy is with the monster or the monster is fearful, but what that is and what the nature of that fear or anxiety or joy represents. I think one of the interests for me is in the sublimity, or the possibility of sublimity in the kaiju, this being that is so far above humanity has nothing to do with it in certain respects. So how do you play with that? And so that's going to be expressed differently, completely differently from a film.
So to broaden this question for everybody, for writers and as readers, how do you as a writer in prose or you as a reader in prose see the way that sublime spectacle is written? How do you write it, and what text have you read that did well, that apply a strong visual storytelling sense to just a prose style
rather than
the kind of medium styles of comics.
That's what I'm going to get. But the author I want to plug here is James S. A. Corey, a.k.a. Ty Frank and Daniel Abraham. His Expanse novels are set in a couple hundred years from now in the solar system where we're expanding out and alien stuff happens. So that is a spoiler, but it does happen in the first book, so it's now up to the fourth novel. And he has these tight character stories, especially involving the crew of the Rosciante, but he also brings aliens crash landing on Venus, space battles, all sorts of visual things that would be expensive to do on film. We're getting to the point where we can do that more cheaply, but again, the point before about the infinite budget, Daniel and Ty use that infinite budget he took a moon of Saturn and destroyed it for kicks. He tried doing that on a film and make it realistic, right, without heavy CGI or models. And it's clear that they've been watching a lot of this SF cinema, Transformers, Star Wars, Star Trek, and have been trying to apply those principles and also trying to keep that character-based focus while having the big budget spectacle. And I think it works.
Yeah, another literary example that's actually science fiction as well, that immediately when you start talking about this idea of the spectacle representing in literature what is sometimes difficult, or a lot easier to represent in film, Tobias Bekele's Xenowalt series, mm-hmm. which some people may be familiar with, Ragamuffin, which is the second book, is the first one that takes place in space, but it includes this just incredible space fight scene, but it's not really outside the ships, it's inside the ships. And he does this amazing thing where he sort of have these people taking pieces of the ship section by section while sort of representing that this larger battle taking place. It's great because I think the way he does it is, on the one hand, we get all this great action, but we also get to see these unique characters sort of coming into their element. We've heard all of these things about Pepper, who's this, there are children here, he's a badass, I'm just saying. Sorry, don't tell anybody. But we actually get to see him finally in action. The same with Nishara, she's been telling us this whole time, like, I have all of these abilities, but I can't use them yet because they're for this moment. So we get to see that sort of broadening out and see the scale of what's going on while at the same time not losing that personal attachment, which I think sometimes in film can be difficult, because you're more focused on just seeing the big flashy thing, not necessarily on the individual people, although that's not exclusively true. But his series is really great in doing that, I think.
And I certainly in the writing Warhammer 40,000, the need to go big is frequent. and I found Dan Abnett's No No Fear absolutely spectacular in this, the conjuring of, you know, multiple kilometer long ships falling out of the sky, crushing the cities below them. But also I think and like his multiple perspectives in Ancillary Justice creates the same kind of possibilities, and that there are moments of in there that I could see. I'd be very curious to see what she does later in the series. I see the potential there for truly explosive spectacle that the groundwork has just been laid for.
I think this is pretty similar to what Sean said, but I think it's always great to see a big spectacle or a disaster filtered through the eyes of the characters. Mm-hmm. And I think knowing what it means to them and what it's going to do to them just makes it so much more than just a description of something that makes me think, well, that's great, I wish I could see it. I think Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Mars is a great example. It ends with, not to get too specific, but massive destruction, and you've spent, you know, hundreds of pages of the book up until then seeing these characters, you know, work from scratch to build this, you know, the beginnings of a civilization on the planet, or, you know, cities. And then to see what happens to it at the end, and to see so many of them caught up in the destruction and watching the things that they've built their lives, that they've spent their lives building, falling apart, is pretty impressive.
An older author that does that really well is Kenneth Lee. She wrote, in her fantasy especially, it's really lush and evocative. It's sort of like Robert E. Howard on acid. It's beautiful descriptions, and you can really see these vistas, and it's just gorgeous. It was a big influence on me. And a lot of fantasy, it's some of it's character and adventure oriented, and some of it's very sort of freeform and more with what we were talking about earlier with gaming, with the emphasis on the world building. But she's done, you know, a ton of books. I don't know how many, but, you know, a lot of different styles. But always, it's such a visual, her writing is so visual and just gorgeous.
I'm just going to come up with another question. This is kind of going back and kind of going forward. I'm going to start this with Paul because he's our resident expert in the long conversation. What SNF media, games, comics, anything outside of literature, do you think has had a big effect on literature? And I'd love to ask you to dig deep into things that are not as obvious, like maybe smaller properties that you think have a disproportionately large impact. And then we'll go through everybody for some other ideas.
Okay, well, superhero comics clearly of large and small have filtered into the long conversation in a number of ways, directly and indirectly. George R. R. Martin's Wild Cards, your own Sheldon Crocus's Superheroes in an Epic Fantasy World. If you think about Gotham City and Gotham City as a character, that's really a very noir sort of setting that I think a lot of readers that haven't read, readers who haven't read Fritz Leiber are taking and using in their own properties. I also think of larger movie properties that are influencing writers to write YA. While things like Harry Potter and The Hunger Games as texts are very extremely popular, the movies are even more popular, and I can't imagine that more than one writer saw those movies and thought, I could write that. I mean, look at Divergent, for example, is clearly inspired by The Hunger Games in text and in cinema. I also see that conversation going backwards and forwards, like, for example, the Hobbit adaptations. And the choices that they are making in those films are clearly looking at the text, looking at the long conversation where we are now in genre and going backwards. I mean, for example, adding in female characters, changing things, bringing things forward, altering the original text to satisfy modern sensibilities. I don't think you could film a straight up Hobbit adaptation as a movie today. People wouldn't go for it, but since we've had this conversation in the last 60 years, going back and forth, I do think that Peter Jackson looked at where we've gone in the genre and has plowed that into the Hobbit films with sometimes mixed results, but I applaud him for trying to engage with what we're doing in the genre.
I want to pick up the YA for a little and get some of your thoughts on how the long conversation plays out in YA, where the audience is different and may in some cases not have as much of a background in reading, and how does that change the way that you reference text or include references for readership that maybe is not doesn't have as much of a depth of background. What does that do for you, and what does that take away in writing for that audience?
Well, the two YA I've written are, they're called steampunk, but it's really more steampunk or fantasy. The technology is magic. Their world is not structured physically like our world. They have ether, levels of ether, you know, the planet's not round. They're going up and down this sort of cascade of worlds through being able to transfer from different etheric planes. So I didn't try to set out, and obviously when you read science fiction fantasy a lot, it's a pretty simple explanation, and it's really accessible, but when you're dealing with people that haven't read a lot of science fiction and fantasy, I didn't want to dive in there. I wanted to see if it as the characters explore the world, the reader learns about it too, and you learn about it at the same pace as the character. And so you're not, you don't have to expect the reader to have all these, you know, preconceptions of what this is going to be like. And in some ways that's very free, because you can kind of do anything you want, and you don't have, you know, your audience will follow along with you, and not be going like, well, yes, but then seeing like it's supposed to, you're supposed to have goggles, and you're supposed to have this, and they don't have a lot of, you know, and someone who's reading it for the first time doesn't have any of those preconceptions, they're just going, ooh, neat, you know, the technology is quite magic, that's cool. So, yeah, I think it can, it's, that's why I'm writing my own. I felt like I was sort of, kind of introducing, hopefully introducing some people to fantasy that hadn't read it before, maybe hadn't read too much of it before, or just really, you know, smaller amounts.
Just a note also, that YA clearly seems to be a gateway for, like, basically everyone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, basically, either for genre or just for reading in general. I mean, there are all kinds of adults who just love the heck out of Hunger Games or Twilight or whatever they happen to be reading. And I find that's really interesting from my perspective as now being an adult, unfortunately. Seeing that this whole generation of people, you know, who are just like, I'll read whatever the heck I want. I'm going to read this young adult stuff, and I don't care. I'm enjoying it. It's fun. And then maybe even picking up stuff outside of that world. It's a very interesting change, I think, with YA in particular.
Well, the fact that YA includes all genres.
Yeah.
Fantasy and science fiction and serial killer and mystery and horror and everything. And there's many ways you can combine those, too. You know, YA is one of the few genres now where you can combine things.
Yeah.
Because in others, it's like because of marketing, and, you know, a lot of my adult books are more the fantasies blended with science fiction, and marketing departments don't want that. They don't like things that fall into more than one category. With YA, you can have things that you can have a magical serial killer horror novel with a mystery in. So, yay, you know, that sounds great. And so, yeah, I think it does give you a lot of opportunities.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I'm going to kind of broaden the question, because at Skipping Fantasy, we've been doing a World SF tour this year, and Sean's really been our leader in pushing that. And I wanted to ask Sean, how do you see the influence between media and literature playing out differently around the world as we've heard from kind of the creators and the consumers of World SF in other parts of the world?
Well, I think there are two things. One is that we do not get a lot of influence from outside, with some exceptions for certain fields of cinema. I mean, David, you probably talk about maybe the influence of, like, the kaiju film and that kind of thing. That certainly had an influence on our own interpretations in American cinema. But we don't get enough material from outside into the United States, or if we do get it, it's fairly limited, with the exception maybe of anime, which is still pretty big. And so one of the things that we've been learning from some of the discussions we've had from people from other countries is how much of an influence the United States has there, Whether intentionally or otherwise, oftentimes through things like the publishing industry about what gets published. I remember when we talked to the Australian folks that one of the things, I think it was the Australians, that one of the things that they noted was that there was an immense pressure for them to write fantasy novels that had the sort of faux European sort of backing underneath it. Sort of, it's set in England, but we're going to call it Monkeyland or whatever. There's this immense pressure to do that, and so what we're seeing in representation is oftentimes funneled through wherever the publishing industry is. It's a very complicated, and I think we haven't gotten to all of the pieces that we really should be talking about, but it is something that, well, by doing this tour, that we're hoping to at least raise some of these questions, because of course if you're talking about an Australian science fiction novel, or a fantasy novel for that matter, the more compelling one seems to me to be the one that would be taking seriously the local color, as it were. But in any case, but in terms of like media, I mean, we've seen a great deal of influence in film by comparison to literature, I think. And I may be wrong, and somebody could point that out. I mean, we're seeing more of these sort of giant monster movies than perhaps we have seen in recent years. I mean, think of Pacific Rim and Godzilla, now they're both going to probably be like 9 movies long. And maybe for good reason. But we're also seeing things like the interjection of film from other nations like South Africa. We have Neil Blomkamp, who's had 2 films now, is probably going to have another one, even though Elysium did not do as well as they expected. We're seeing more and more Japanese cinema that is based on adaptations of either manga, and we're talking like live action cinema, based on manga, sometimes on novels. We just had Edge of Tomorrow, which is based on a Japanese novel called All You Need Is Kill, which was then translated by Hikasoru. So we're seeing more and more of it, I think, than we have before, and I suspect that the influence is yet to be seen on the broader conversation. So what will the influence of South African SF have on U.S. SF? I don't know yet, because it's not been long enough. But it's there, and it is something that we're clearly willing to spend money to go see, and I suspect that influence is going to get bigger, but I feel like I'm rambling.
I do wonder, Sean, that if film might be the gateway that we get some of these influences into literature, but from that film to literature sort of gateway, but from the world, from world cinema influencing writers to write in certain ways.
Well, and that's something to just mention too, that with Edge of Tomorrow, I think Nick Mamatas, who edits at Hikasoro, noted on Twitter at some point that when the movie came out and people found out that it was All You Need Is Kill, that it shot up the Amazon sales ranking or whatever, that like it was like the top 20 or something. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head. So clearly the film served as a gateway to get people to try the book.
Yeah.
Whether they were reading the really terrible Edge of Tomorrow version with Tom Cruise on the cover, or they read the original version, All You Need Is Kill. And I think that's also something that's really crucial, is that, as you were noting, that the film or other media, but particularly film because it's so big, it can serve as a gateway to these literatures and comics and whatever from these other places, because suddenly we see this thing and then it says based on a book by so-and-so, and we're like, well, where is the book? Where do I go read the book? Because a lot of people do. They want to read the book when they see it, or they find out it's based on a comic. They want to read the comic. And so that becomes, it feeds that need, and suddenly we have a market. So, which is why everybody should go see Edge of Tomorrow. So that was all my secret spiel for that. But did anyone else want to add something to that?
I think, too, it depends a little bit on, as far as film is concerned, we see sometimes individual influences. I mean, I think it might be fair to say that Australian cinema defined what post-apocalyptic film looks like for us, right? The Mad Max films set the template for every direct-to-video 1980s film directed by Albert Pyun that would follow. Science fiction in film is a more expensive proposition to do well, whereas something like horror, there we see a massive international influence throughout as far as the North American version is concerned, whether it's the influx of German filmmakers in the 20s and 30s, or the wave of Japanese horror then arriving and being remade or simply being embraced more recently.
I think it's also interesting to see how sometimes foreign projects are reinterpreted for what someone thinks the American audience needs. Snowpiercer is a great example. I'm so excited about this movie, and I'm very excited that it seems that they decided not to change it for the American release. there was this discussion that went on before, I guess maybe months ago. I don't know exactly how long ago, but it's supposed to be a great film. It's got an ensemble cast of, you know, British actors, American actors, Korean actors, and it looks fantastic. And supposedly the Weinsteins were saying, well, what we need to do is we need to, you know, add or cut these parts and add in a monologue so that everybody can understand it, which is, you know, a real shame that you'd hear something like that, especially after Blade Runner. But it looks like it's going to be released the way it was meant to be seen, and so that's great news.
I think the same idiot has been working at every film studio, because every bad sci-fi or fantasy movie has either a monologue narration in the beginning or both the monologue narration and a screen that tells you the story beforehand, and sometimes at the same time, somebody reading it to you.
Alone in the Dark.
Yeah, Alone in the Dark. This happens so often, I don't know why they think that the audience wants to be read to. Like, we've been reading Star Wars, the opening of Star Wars, for so long, I think we can figure it out. And I lost, but I was going to add something to that, and then I totally... Oh, reinterpretations. Edge of Tomorrow. It's an interesting thing, because it's a Japanese novel that's optioned and then turned into a film. And they do alter the social context a bit. In the original, it takes place in Japan as a Japanese man, and the main character, Rita, is actually an American. In this case, they translate it to Europe, and I think very deliberately so, to sort of as a play on D-Day, essentially, because that's basically what they've done, is instead of invading one of the islands of Japan to get back the land from the aliens, they're invading Europe to take back Europe. And it's very obviously, they're staging it from the United Kingdom, they're basically invading in the same pattern, exactly. So
released on June the 6th.
And even yes. Released on, yeah, on the day. So I think there was a deliberate, they saw this and they said, we'll do this. That's not as problematic as maybe a reinterpretation where they say, like, because this one, I don't get the sense that they were saying, like, well, Americans are too dumb, they're not going to understand the Japanese context. But in some cases, that does happen, where they'll say, like, well, Americans don't understand Korea, so we'll just make them, like, white guys living in, you know, Osaka, and that'll fix the problem. And it doesn't always. It creates more issues, because, of course, it's a lot of assumptions about the audience. And as we've seen many examples where this is not true. Where we have, for example, Pacific Rim, which we just talked about in the previous panel. There are all kinds of people from all over the place, and for some reason people didn't seem to have a problem with that. We figured it out. You even had, although it was not financially successful, the film Cloud Atlas, which some people may have seen, and I suspect that... Yeah, good. It's a great film. There's a lot of really interesting things with, interpreting the novel and, of course, representing these futuristic versions of South Korea in particular. So...
I wanted to open up to the audience if anyone had questions. This is for a fair number of topics, and then also if you have questions for any of our participants directly. If you look, please accept.
World building.
Ask you a question. So for podcast audience, we're going to ask folks to ask questions in the room. Thank you so much.
Don't put it too close to your face.
Okay.
There you go.
World building. When you're trying to tell a story, do you start with the world and then write the story, or do you start with the story and build the world around it? And does that change when you go from one meeting to the other?
With me, it's the world builds the character, and the character builds the world, kind of. The world has to be the kind of place that would create the kind of character that I want to write. And so if I want to write a particular kind of character, I have to design the world so that it would produce that person. And then once you have that, the story kind of evolves naturally out of that for me. What is this person's goal going to be? What are they trying to do? What's trying to be? What's somebody trying to do for them? You know, that kind of those kind of questions that go on to evolve the story. But for me, I can't really separate world building from character, from the main character, because it's sort of your viewpoint character, because it's just, it should be, to me, it should be so integral that, you know, you can't design one without coming up with the other.
I think my process is pretty similar to Martha's. For The Buried Life, I definitely started with a kind of world I wanted to create, and then the questions were, okay, well, what happens in this world, and what are the problems there, and what are the kinds of people that would, like, push the boundaries of this world and get into trouble in it? And as far as writing for games, I came into the project I'm working on right now, which is called Pillars of Eternity, kind of partway through when a lot of the world and the plot had already been determined. But I think the important thing there is just always to make sure that you're NPCs and, you know, the people running around in this world reinforce it. I think it's easy to look at these as separate building blocks and to say, okay, well, here's a quest the player does, given by these people whose job is to give quests. And, you know, to whatever extent you can say, no, this is a person with a vivid inner life and a story of their own, even if you don't see it, what are the things that they can say and do that will bring that out and that will comment on the world they live in?
And I think I'd second both of those, what you said. It's certainly, with Warhammer 40,000, I already have a pre-existing world, and in some cases, pre-existing characters that I'm playing with, but yes, those characters are going to be shaped by the world, but also the world is made up of all of these characters and therefore being shaped by them. So, yeah, I would agree absolutely with about the absolute intertwining of the two.
Do you have any other questions as well?
Going back to what Sean had said about it seeming like there's just one bad director in every sci-fi mm-hmm. fantasy film who thinks that the audience needs to be read to, there's an author I enjoy, Aileen Martinez, who's observed that he says that the problem that we're having now is that we have directors and producers and helmsmen who don't really enjoy sci-fi fantasy, who don't really necessarily read it themselves or understand it, but are producing these movies, and so they're doing things that, you know, that a lot of us wouldn't necessarily do, that they don't have the fan understanding of the genre that we might want. Do you guys think that's the case? Is that an issue with film, sci-fi fantasy film today?
Oh,
I'd say yes.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there's probably some truth to that. I don't know how much truth, but that's because I haven't polled all of the directors and snuck into their houses and get their private calls. But yeah, I would say there's probably some truth to that, and I think partly because science fiction films in particular right now are basically the breadwinners. If you look at the last few years, pretty much all of the biggest movie moneymakers are either fantasy films, or direct sci-fi, so like Hunger Games was like, what, top four last year? I think it was. This year, I mean, already we've got Captain America and
Godzilla.
You know, all of these films, they're sci-fi films, right? Or fantasy sometimes make do well. So I think there's some degree probably in Hollywood where they see, well, this makes a lot of money, and also it's going to be good for you because it'll help your little career. Mm-hmm. Doesn't necessarily mean they're always fan. I think in Godzilla's case, Gareth Edwards considers himself a fan. But maybe that's not true for all of them. They're possibly doing it because this is, of course, I'm getting it in an option, but they may not know the field. But, I mean, you could say that of almost, I mean, I don't know, Westerns. If you asked me to direct a Western, I'd probably screw that up. Yeah.
I don't know, sir. I think it's also the matter of the expectations and conservatism of Hollywood wanting to make their money back. So they have to follow certain things and not try to make their budget. I mean, so you wind up stock things over and over again because, well, this is what worked the last time. This is what we got 150 million people to watch. This is what we need this time, and we don't want to take a chance because we might lose money.
That would go back to this myth that we've now thoroughly debunked, the idea that people will not go to sci-fi movies with women as the main characters, which is baloney, because Hunger Games is a big example. Divergent was financially successful.
Gravity, her,
but it was a small film, so it was financially successful too, yeah. Although she's not really the main character, but anyway, whatever. There are expectations Hollywood has for how film has to be done. And I don't know what all those expectations are. We can only figure them out based on what they release. And based on a lot of the sci-fi films, as you're noting, right, there seem to be traditions that keep repeating, and they don't want to seem to push the buttons. And sometimes when they do, they just, like, they tank it themselves by saying, we're just going to pretend that doesn't exist. Like, you know, Cloud Atlas. Nobody wanted to touch it. They had to get independent funding for that. And if you've not seen Cloud Atlas, that film is ambitious and amazing. You may not like it, but you could recognize that it is doing something that no other sci-fi film has probably ever done. And I say probably because I'm not 100%, I haven't seen them all. David, I know you want something.
Well, I think it's also a difference. I think the tension that Carrie pointed out involving the release of Snowpiercer, I think highlights it. That there are plenty of directors who clearly are fans, Guillermo del Toro, Peter Jackson, James Cameron, whatever, you know, even Paul W.S. Anderson, we might have, whatever you might think of his films, he's a fan of the material that he's dealing with. So there's a difference between perhaps the filmmaker and then the people who are actually calling the shots further up. And ever since the arrival of the blockbuster era and the consolidation of the studios are now no longer run by filmmakers but by accountants, we get situations where the kind of conservatism that Paul was just describing, and the difficulty for the need to fund independently for something like Cloud Atlas, unless the filmmaker, I mean, bizarrely, Roland Emmerich is strictly speaking an independent filmmaker because he's just an independent filmmaker who's able to raise $100 million to do whatever he wants.
All right, let's take one more question.
And you were talking earlier about how there's been a lot of non-US-based influence before, but we see Japanese horror films and the Stitch, I think Let Me In was a horror film from Sweden, and all those things and how that has been influencing American horror, etc. But then you also mentioned that it's been taking a longer time for those outside influences to come to sci-fi. Why do you think that's so?
I think there's probably still a tendency to see science fiction and fantasy as perhaps more of their own genres than they really are. I think most science fiction and fantasy stories are really adventure stories or love stories or, they're just set in a different kind of world. And I think that a lot of people find that world building and having to get their head in this other space very intimidating. But I think one great thing that YA is doing that we've touched on and that also crossover artists, writers like Margaret Atwood and Michael Chabon, they're saying, no, you can tell these stories, it's just in a different world, and if you like these kinds of stories, you'll like them in this setting too. But I still think that that's a mental block that some people have to get past.
Yeah, I would add, just to kind of go to the more particular question of why we're not seeing as much influence from outside in science fiction, there's a big problem too with, there are lots of directors who are working, like Neil Blomkamp is an example, but he's an exception. I mean, there are not many South African directors. I think there was one other that did a sci-fi movie, but I cannot remember who it was now, and that probably just illustrates the problem. But there are all of these directors, but the big problem is, of course, that sci-fi movies are usually not cheap. A horror film you could make for like $5 million, you can make a really good horror film. Not to say that it's a bad thing, Duke, because I know this is your...
But I agree with you, actually.
Yeah, you can make an exceptional horror film for like $5 million. Granted, you could spend more and make a better one. But with science fiction, right, you're not going to have a great space adventure for $5 million unless somebody like Tom Cruise is saying, I won't get paid and I'll pay you, right, to let me be in the movie. And so it becomes much of a bigger gamble, I think, in Hollywood to say, like, well, we should take this thing that is from over there or this director from where I'm going to spill water on, this director from this country or whatever who has not been vetted, et cetera, because the money thing is always going to be a question. They want their money back. So they're going to go to somebody like Michael Bay because whatever anybody thinks of Michael Bay's movies, he makes them a lot of money. And there's somebody somewhere who's just like swimming in a pool of money like Scrooge McDuck, right? And that's not necessarily evil. It's just a matter of, like, it's a business. They're going to make money, and to get those outside influences, to get them to adapt things from outside, you have to convince them they can make money on it. Which is why something like, I hate to be like the shill for Edge of Tomorrow, but that film failing is not good. If it does not do financially well, that's not actually a good thing. And that was a big worry with Pacific Rim, because it was an example of this kind of film doing very unique things with nationalities. And if that was a film that failed, people were like, well, that's it. I mean, even there were even concerns that Godzilla might be tanked. Because you can't, if they're not going to go to this one, well then, whatever, that's it. So it's money. And honestly, you just have to put your butts in the seats. So if like all of you bought like 5 million tickets for that one movie, we'd be good. So.
They'd also be impoverished.
Well, yeah. You might also be in debt. But that's a lot of tickets.
Yeah, well, we're almost at time. That's a good note. That if there's something out there that you want to see having more of an influence, buy it, talk about it, and speak about it to other people, and then that will spread the word.
Yeah.
I want to thank our wonderful guests, Martha Wells and Carrie Patel. I'd like to ask each of you to briefly remind us where we can find you on the internet and in the world, and then we'll do a list if you wrap up.
I'm at MarthaWells.com, and that's got links to my Twitter and Facebook and Tumblr. I'm on everything, basically. Yeah, just I'm online all the time.
Best place to find me is at @Carrie_Patel. That's Carrie like the Stephen King character, and Patel like every Patel. You can also find me at electronicinkblog.com.
But David, DavidAnandale.com, and on Twitter @David_Anandale.
And Sean, can you
get
all of our Stephen King fantasy
materials? Oh, yeah, we're on a webpage somewhere.
SkippyandFanty.com.
Yeah, our webpage is SkippyandFanty.com, Skippy with a K. If you'd like to send us an email, it's just SkippyandFanty@gmail.com. We're also on Twitter @SkippyandFanty. We supposedly have a Facebook page and like a Google Plus, but I mean, who goes on Google Plus? Oh, poor thing. Yeah, but those are the big ones. But yeah, and you can subscribe like via iTunes. There's also RSS feeds, and we also have a blog. It's on skippingfanny.com. It's got stuffs in it and nifty things. He writes about books like all the time. All the time.
All so. Well, thank you so much for being a wonderful audience and your great questions, and thanks. Have a great con.
Thank you.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
From different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.